Right now, Bruce Pratt here with this week's edition of Sports Lit 101. And we were talking about this a little bit during the break. Man, everybody wants to send us their books these days.
I have, I think, 8 hardcover books that have arrived in just the last 7 or 8 days. and I just, while we were talking earlier, Syracuse announced to me that they're going to send me something more. So, yeah, it's great. And the authors tell me that it makes a difference when they're on. I mean, now they're going to say, gee, I looked up and I sold 14 books on Amazon today. And
nice.
The only promotion I did was with you guys or whatever. So, you know, yeah, it's working out. If, the first thing I want to do before we talk about the book we're going to mostly talk about today is mention a book that when I first started doing this with you, it was one of the early books we talked about, A Sportsman's Life, How I Build Orphis by Mixing Business and Sport by Lee Perkins. I had the rare and wonderful opportunity to meet Lee. I had known his son in prep school who died right after he graduated from prep school in a terrible fishing accident. And I had written an essay about him, and it found its way to his brother, Perk, Lee Jr. And Lee invited me out to his ranch in Wyoming to fish with him for 5 days, and he and his wife, Annie. And that was, they didn't know me from Adam. Hmm. I mean, it was an incredibly generous, very kind man. But this book, A Sportsman's Life, taught me something that I think I knew, but I didn't really fully understand. You know, if the more often you go to museums, the more often you appreciate great art. I think you develop a deeper understanding of it. If you've gone to the Louvre and the Uffizi and the Alhambra and the MoMA and all these places, you see all this kind of art, you start to appreciate it on a different level. What Lee Perkins knew is the more time you spend outdoors, the more you appreciate the earth for what it is, and the planet and our natural resources. And he used to say, no one should ever feel sorry for me. No one ever had a reason to feel sorry for me. He was born well-to-do, never had to work. But he bought this little company up in Vermont, Orvis, that was selling about $500,000 a year worth of product and doing that business. And 30 years later, in 1992, when he retired as CEO, it was a $100 million organization. And it was, as far as I know, and I'm not an expert on this, the first company to devote 5% of its pre-tax profits to conservation and environmental things. Mm. They have restored habitat, bought habitat, protected habitat. And people cynically say, well, of course, if you're fishing and hunting, you want to have the fishing hunting list. But I can tell you, I met the man, and it was a much deeper and much more sincere belief in his heart. We'll be a better nation, a better people, and a better world the more we take care of our environment. As I say, Lee passed away last week at the age of 93, and near his home in one of his homes that he had in Florida. He, in his early 90s, was fishing or hunting 250 days a year.
Wow.
He was a catch-and-release fly guy in Wyoming. We would catch 25, 30, 40 trout in the morning. Put them all back, and he'd just laugh and sort of look at them and say, see you again. but a very generous man, and whenever people lay all the woes of the world on corporations, and Lord knows a lot of it belongs there, they should know about the people that run some of them. And he was a really remarkable guy. And his son, Ralph, was a wonderful young man, taught me to fly fish. And we have lifetime, there are things we learn that we do our whole life. And for me, fly fishing is one of them. And I just wanted to let people know that's Lions Press, L-Y-O-N-S, A Sportsman's Life. It's a great book if you want to really read about someone who said, well, I want to like what I do. And he said, I never went to work one day in my life. And I always was doing what I wanted to do. So wanted to bring that up about Lee. And so this book, Escape from Castro's Cuba by Tim Wendel. Tim is one of the founding members of the USA Today Baseball Weekly. He's a writer in residence at Johns Hopkins. He's written a lot of books, including a book which predates this book in a linear sense, which I've not read, but I'm sure I will. Whenever I get a book and it's written about the past and it's a fiction book and it's written about a place where most people haven't been, I tend to get very suspicious of it. But when this came in, I flipped over to the back, and this is the first thing I read. Few know Cuba and its national pastime of baseball better than Tim Wendel. few are still right about it with such honesty, grace, and insight. Luis Tion.
Wow.
I thought, okay.
that's a pretty good endorsement.
Yeah, that's a pretty good endorsement. And himself having written his memoir, Son of Havana. And then Danielle Silva, who wrote a book, Jane Levy, who wrote The Big Fella, Babe Ruth and the World that he created, which we've talked about. I think we spoke with her, too.
Yes, we did.
He said, in Billy Bryan, Tim Wendell has created the perfect baseball man. And in this novelistic return to the world of Cuban baseball and intrigue has given Billy a perfect second act. I've been long enthralled with the fact that when the Havana Sugar Kings were playing the New York Yankees, a spent bullet from one of Castro's troops hit a Yankee player, and that was the end of professional baseball in Cuba for a long time. The Cubans love baseball, and the Cubans have given us a lot of great baseball players. I never had a Yankee I liked better than El Duque. And this goes back to the time when right before the revolution or as it's unfolding and then moves forward. It's fiction, but Castro is in it and he plays a role in it. One of the interesting pieces of the book, and I'm not going to tell people much about this because this plot relies to a great extent on the way this plays out. Castro shows up at a game, walks onto the field, grabs the ball, and looks at the catcher and says, I'm going to pitch to him. This is in his early days, right? He's, a teenager leading a revolution. And strikes out this big leaguer with the best 12-6 curveball that this Billy Bryan has ever seen. And Bryan gets to know Castro a little at that time, and he thinks later in the book, I wonder if I'd encouraged him to play baseball, if things would have been different in Cuba, if there would have been no revolution the way it was. That little piece is the key that starts this book going in 1,000 directions, which get wrapped up in the end. There are times when, if I was reading and thinking, God, I think I'm, oh, he brought that back nicely. Wendell is also a journalist and has written a number of nonfiction books, he brings that kind of economy of prose to some of the dialogue, which makes it work. There's nothing worse than having the dialogue have to explain everything in a story. And he has great transitions. And the characters are all believable. And there are a couple of things that wouldn't normally be believable, but the way he sets them up really makes you believe that he knew a lot about it. Well, it turns out he's been to Cuba on more than one occasion and does know more than a little bit about Cuban baseball. And some of the work that he's done, some of his other books, he also gets a rave endorsement from Ken Burns, another person who we take very seriously here. But he lets the narrative flow back and forth between the U.S. and time in Cuba. It's not, he mentions Hemingway, those kinds of all those cultural touchstones. But he's written a lot of books, nonfiction books, down to the last pitch of the 91 Minnesota Twins. Atlanta Braves gave us the best World Series of all time. The New Face of Baseball, the 100-Year Rise and Triumph of Latinos in America's Favorite Sport. So over the years, he's written a lot about both baseball and Latin American baseball. I think we can still say Latin America. I don't think I've said the wrong thing there. I try to keep up with what we're supposed to say. But it's remarkable to me that as we look around now, once again, there's this huge influx of players from the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. The 8% of the Major League baseball players are of African American descent. Now, there was a time when that was much higher, and it is really becoming in many ways a Latin players' ball game. And we're seeing, as we have with an Alex Cora, we're seeing more and more managers, Francona and Alomar and people like that have come up, moved on, and I'm forgetting several. But we're seeing that, and you really begin to see, and we've read all those, we've talked about those nonfiction books, The Pitcher and the Dictator, and books that we've had about Latin American baseball, that it is still an incredibly important part of the fabric of that country. And next week, we'll talk a little bit in this a memoir we're going to be talking about, Clubby, how the Dominican dynamic is really different, which we first came across in Pitching in the Promised
Land. Right. Excellent. And so this is called Escape from Castro's Cuba by Tim Wendell, and we'll see if down the road we can maybe get Tim to come on and talk with us.
Yeah, I'm going to get them to send me his previous novel, Castro's Curveball, and set up a time to talk to him.
Very cool. And you mentioned next week. What else is ahead? Any don't have to have any specific dates, but other things that we'll be chatting about as we cruise into summertime.
Yeah. Next week, the book Clubby, which is the memoir of a young man who was the clubhouse manager for the Aberdeen A-ball affiliate of the Ironbirds of the Orioles, play at Cal Ripken's personal little stadium there. It's really interesting, and it really makes you look at the minor leagues, and you see some things that really don't aren't so attractive about minor league baseball, but there's a lot that is cool. And then I have books coming up on Tony Lazzari, on Jack Kennedy in baseball in 1962. We have the one on the Twins that I think you got first. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of baseball books coming up, but we're going to start setting up some authors to chat with, too.
Nice. Speaking of minor league baseball, did you guys see any of the pictures or video from Polar Park, the new stadium in Worcester?
No, I didn't.
Wow. It is beautiful.
It's and Polar is has been in Worcester as long as I've been alive.
And I'm pretty sure the woman who designed it is the woman who did the great work at Camden Yards, designing that, and then you designed the renovations to Fenway that turned it into what it's become over the course of the last 15 years or so. And she's amazing. She's somebody who ought to be in the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's some interesting things about that in Clubby, too, about Hall of Famers and who gets in, who doesn't, and how much of it might be politics.
What? Politics in the Hall of Fame?
You know, it's funny because I go back to what I was talking about with Lee Perkins. He said to me, we get politics out of the environmental movement and the conservation movement, things would be better. He says, I don't know why some conservatives don't want to believe in conservation. He said, and I don't know why some liberals think that all of us who are in business are out to destroy the universe. And, that's so much of it, isn't it?
Absolutes. Absolutes, absolutes. Are never all that good.
Lines in the sand.
Janet Marie Smith, by the way, that's her name, the designer of Polar Park and others.